Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by awesome Patreon backers like the daring Daniel Markwick, the excellent Erica Bond Barbagris, and the mysterious Michael Beck Esperum. Today, we have myself, Ange, along with Josh and repeat guest Carl Lehman. And in this episode, we are going to talk about steaks. No, not the fancy cut of beef you get at a good restaurant, but the things that make the events in the game important to your players and their characters. Before we dive into that topic, though, we're going to lean into the whole synonyms of steaks, and I want you to tell me about a time you dealt with a vampire in an RPG. Josh, go.
Oh, this is fun. This is one of my favorite RPG stories. Okay, so back in college, we were doing a 3.5 game, and our GM had this whole undead theme. Like, the theme was basically, F skeletons again. But this led us to fighting all different kinds of undead, like every undead in the Monster Manual, including vampires. So as we are fighting our way into this yawning abyss to face down the big, bad, evil guy, which was a lich, of course, we got attacked by vampires. Now, the whole way down, the GM had us rolling dexterity saves because we were going down this big spiral staircase, and in the center was like a black hole, like sucking us in. So we had to fight against that while we were still climbing down the stairs. And then like vampires jump out, and he was like, haha, gotcha. And so our spellcaster casts daylight, and he's like, that's okay, they'll just turn into mist that then gets sucked into the yawning abyss. Okay, next encounter.
That is hilarious.
This is the best part of that game. I mean, there was a lot of good parts in that game, but that is the part that I will always retell.
And, you know, I feel a little for the GM because you expect it to be this huge epic encounter, and then it just fizzles.
Oh, it was gonna be such like the swashbuckling on the edge of the staircase while trying to get pulled in, and you know, everybody like holding on for dear life and everything like that, and they're just like poof, oops, zoop.
Carl, what about you?
It has been a very long time since I dealt with a vampire. I think one of the more memorable experiences I had was at an Origins a couple years ago when I played Knights Black Agents for the first time. Because one of the things they do is pull a lot of very, like, not obscure. They're obviously not obscure to their region, but they pull a lot of unique vampire myths. And so we're going through this adventure trying to figure things out. We keep ignoring like the references to like a pig and like a wild boar in the background and stuff like that. Come to find at the end of the adventure that the vampire type could shapeshift, but could only shapeshift. It was like a obscure German vampire that could shapeshift into like a razor tusk boar, but not anything else. It was like a feral vampire. So we ended up fighting it in an old monastery and things like that. I got my ass kicked. Most of the party got their ass kicked. And my friend Bob like leapt in and dealt the killing blow. And afterwards, we were comparing stats. He was like, yeah, it was weird. That game had such low health. And we're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, I only had like 3 or 4 points of health. I'm like, I had like 12. He's like, you did? I was so weak compared to you. Why did you let me do that? I'm like, I don't know, man.
I had a Knights Black Agents game. I ran for one group of friends. And then when the pandemic happened, I just, for reasons, I needed something easy to run for my group. So I kind of pulled that whole concept and kind of reran that campaign with different players. The whole concept behind it is they were a team that was sent into Vienna to check on a team that had gone silent. The team that had gone silent was there to find a computer analyst who had basically run off with a bunch of data that could have compromised a whole bunch of secret intelligence agents across the world. And so they needed to get him and get that data before he sold it to somebody. The whole thing is they're kind of realizing that there's something supernatural going on. The team that they were checking on had been wiped out by something horrendous. And there's like screenshots of a fanged face in the security footage, all of this. The whole thing is leads up to a climax at the Vienna Opera House. I was kind of inspired by one of the Mission Impossibles for this. And the whole thing is they're supposed to have their first run-in with the vampire at the Opera House, as you've got them, the vampire, and Russians, intelligence, vying to get their hands on the guy and the data. Well, the funny thing is I named the guy, the guy's name was Dwayne Johnson.
Oh, no.
And he was using all of these aliases that were based on The Rock's characters in various movies. And he was just this schlub who was in way over his head and living life to the best. And he's at the opera with some lady. He paid to be there with him. And the funny thing is in both of the campaigns, they somehow ended up getting him into the bathroom to try and get the data chip off of him as the vampire is basically starting to attack everyone else in the opera. And it just it confounded me how both groups somehow ended up doing exactly the same thing, even though it wasn't remotely planned. It was get Dwayne Johnson into the bathroom to either manhandle him to get the data chip and pull the fire alarm in the opera house to get everyone out and cause chaos so they could get away from the vampire.
Wow.
It went chaos in both sessions. Just in one, they tried to seduce Dwayne Johnson, and in the other, they just basically mugged him.
I mean, valid, I guess, in either way, depending on your thoughts on Dwayne Johnson.
I had the best picture, too. He was just this nerdy, chubby guy who was, you know, trying to wear fancier clothing than he actually could pull off. So let's move into our main topic and talk about stakes. So what are stakes in TTRPGs? If you dig into the dictionary definition, once you get past pointed sticks, you get to something you could win or lose in a game or contest, and interest or involvement in something. Now, while we are playing games, it's that last bit that we're really aiming for when we talk about stakes in the games we run. So how do you get your players and their characters invested in what's going on and use that to facilitate the excitement and drama of the game's narrative? Let's dive in. Starting off, our first question is going to be, so are stakes a matter of winning or losing for the players?
So I think they can be, but my preferred way of using stakes is to escalate the dramatic tension if I can. I want to try and up the ante or find a way to up the players' buy-in in the plot or some aspect of their background that they're working on. Sometimes it can be, you know, you can win, you can lose, but I think stakes are really, really good when they escalate some aspect of the game.
What are your thoughts, Josh?
I would say that for the players, stakes in an RPG shouldn't be about winning or losing. For the characters, definitely. I mean, depending on the stakes. The stakes could be you have to go and play a high-stakes game of Baccarat or something like that in order to get the nuclear launch codes from Mads Mikkelsen. In which case, yeah, they could lose that, but losing for the characters shouldn't be losing for the players. It should just lead to more interesting story and more interesting drama for the players.
I think if you think of stakes only in terms of winning or losing, it does a disservice to the game.
Mm, yeah.
Because sometimes the most interesting story can happen when the players are not, when the characters are not winning.
Yes.
Like, when they're struggling to achieve what they want. And it's a balance to make sure that, you know, you're keeping the story of the game interesting and not completely frustrating your players. You know, there is a little bit of winning and losing in there, but it can't be the sum total of the stakes in your game.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I like doing horrible things to my characters, but that's not everybody's playstyle or how everybody likes to enjoy the game, right? Some people enjoy the power fantasy of being much more capable than they are in everyday life, which is a completely valid way of playing the game. But stories are better when they're about struggle.
Yeah.
And so having even that potential of strife or grief for the character will just make the game that much more satisfying when you get to the end of it.
So what do you aim for when setting stakes in your games?
So I try very hard to keep them very personal to the characters and make them something, I like if you're thinking about it in terms of like Marvel movies and comic books, like what Marvel calls like street level, like that's where I always start. And then it usually balloons into Thanos' coming with the Infinity Gauntlet world ending stakes. And I try my damnedest to make sure it doesn't escalate quickly.
Yeah.
I try really hard to make sure that the stakes progress in a way that feels natural so that it starts off with like, go get this thing, otherwise you're going to be fired in terms of the universe, that's pretty low stakes. But then by the end of the campaign, I always want it to be like the fabric of reality is untwirling and you're the only one that can weave it back together.
I find it personally very important to make the stakes personal to the characters, so it's organic for the players to lean in to doing whatever is set in front of them in the game. Because I play with fantastic people. They'll pick up the plot hook no matter what. It doesn't matter if the adventure really doesn't mean anything to the characters. They'll play because we're there together to have fun. But the games that everyone remembers are the ones where the stakes, the reasons why the characters are getting involved, are personal to them. What are your thoughts, Carl?
I tend to go for one of two different varieties. Either a character-focused, like emotional gut punch, or going for something that affects the whole group but sort of twists their understanding of what was going on. And I think probably the most effective times that I pull off a twist or a stake raising like that, they're almost always character moments. I think one of the best ones that I've ever, you know, that I'm most proud of, I don't know if it's one of the best ones I've ever done, one of my favorites personally was I had a player in a Rogue Trader game give me a 25-page backstory to start with in short story form, and it was great. This person was not at all familiar with the 40K universe, and she went out and read a couple books and like kind of came up with an idea. When I delivered the twist on her backstory, I wrote the same scenes that she said from the other characters and gave those characters internal thoughts as to what was actually going on during her character backstory. And she realized that she had been running from something that she could have embraced in session one.
Ah, beautiful.
In her backstory, she uncovered that this shipping company that she worked for was the front for an Inquisitor. She was like, oh God, what do I do now? And so she ran to the Rogue Trader and like went sectors away. The second she left, the Inquisitor put her on the payroll, like the Inquisition payroll, as an interrogator, because he was her father.
Oh.
So the whole entire shipping company was literally him creating something from the ground up so that she could slowly work her way in. And she did, but because it's 40K and you got to do stuff like that, somebody in the administratum misfiled something. And the wrong shipment went to the wrong place, and she got exposed to too much too early. When I revealed that, it was in the form of the character literally got her father's memories of her backstory through an actual like psychic transfer.
Oh, that's awesome.
The next three sessions were the players dealing with the fallout of that. And it ended up just being one of the great moments of the campaign. Like, that campaign was really, really nice for a lot of moments, but that's by far one of the ones I'm most proud of.
That's really cool. I've had a kind of an opposite experience. I've been running a Coriolis game for some friends. This is based on a published adventure. The way things start off is you are asked, basically you have this NPC that is supposed to ask the PCs to come help them do something on the Coriolis space station. And you're encouraged to tie it to one of the PCs. And so one of my PCs decided that the NPC was her ex-girlfriend. Ooh. Okay, fine. So we lean into it. They get there. They find out she's missing. They start investigating. It's this whole mystery. And the whole first act is them trying to find out what happened to their friend and get her. And so like the other PCs are there just for support for their teammate, for their crew member. And then it's supposed to shift into investigating the kidnapping of this large, influential person. And I very quickly realized I was going to have trouble with that transition because the players were so focused on the missing girlfriend.
Oh.
The adventure provides a more ham-fisted way to get them involved. But it's still like they were having conversations like, do we care that this mysterious big shot is missing, has been kidnapped? We don't care. That has nothing to do with what we're doing. And I'm sitting here in the background going, it has everything to do with what you guys are doing, but it's not clear in the way the adventure. So the stakes for transitioning from one investigation to the other had to be kind of like helped along a little bit.
That kind of like perfectly encapsulates one of the issues when you make your stakes too big. I've done a lot of writing for nonprofit organizations and like their asks at, you know, the end of the year when everybody's like, please donate money to us. And one of the things that you learn with that is that like statistics, people don't care about big numbers. They care about one person and one story. Like if you say like, this is how your money can help this person, instead of saying like, your money will help thousands of people. No, give them a face and they'll be more inclined to give you their money. It's the same sort of thing when you're talking about stakes in a story. And see, this is a problem that I have with making everything world ending or universe ending or reality unraveling or whatever. That becomes too big. We see it too many times and then it becomes kind of boring. But as soon as it's somebody's girlfriend, well, screw everything else. We want to make sure that they get to kiss.
My problem with the way the adventure is written is it almost forgets about the ex-girlfriend as it transitions them to the mystery of what happened to this big mysterious figure.
Yeah.
And it's like, my players are here for Rahita. They're not here for the emissary. I'm still making it work, and I find it to be an interesting adventure, but I do have some issues with that. But that brings me up to, let's talk about, how do you think of stakes in terms of campaign, session, and encounter? Because, like, obviously your campaign has stakes, but then so do your session or, like, story beats sessions and the encounters themselves.
So when I generally sit down to plan a campaign, I think we talked about this in the first episode I was on, I start at the end. I know what the highest stakes in the game are going to be, and I can start. I can step down over narrative arcs from that. I know that I'm ending with, oh, Thanos is here, but I can step it back and work my way down to lower and lower level stakes, but ones that are still going to be appropriate for whatever arc I want to tell during that phase of the game.
Mm-hmm.
I don't generally think of stakes in terms of sessions. Stakes are something that are delicate enough that you only want to really touch them from like a narrative perspective a couple of times per game as a GM. I think one of the more powerful things is to let your players change the stakes for you. Your story about the Coriolis game, Ange, is really interesting because they've clearly decided what the stakes are, even though that's not actually what's going on. But meanwhile, here you are, you know, behind the scenes with a Dremel filing the serial numbers off. Those games have more buy-in from the players. And I think anytime we can get more buy-in from people, it makes a better game, even if it requires a little bit more work from us on the back end.
Your thoughts, Josh?
Yeah, I like what Carl was saying about starting at the end with what you know you want your end stakes to be, because when it comes to campaign, I look at the length of the campaign. Just by happenstance, I've run a lot of like D20 style systems, Pathfinder, Starfinder, that sort of stuff. And at the start, we are always like, okay, we're going to go from 1 to 20.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that I'm going to be running a multi-year campaign.
And other lies we tell.
My Pathfinder characters just started at level 19 on Monday. So
nice.
I'm going to get there. My point being, like, I know I'm going to run a multi-year campaign. I have the space to bring in those world-ending, world-unraveling threats.
Yeah.
If it's just going to be like a 5-session campaign, I don't really have room for that. When we talk about stakes for campaigns, I would always start with the length of it and how much room we have to build it up. And if you want those big stakes, then that just means you got to start closer to them, right? You got to start off with bigger stakes.
See, this is all very smart. This is why I do these podcasts, because I am horrible about doing that, of, you know, understanding where I want the campaign to kind of end and then, you know, working my way backwards to the beginning. I usually set stuff up in the beginning of what my premise is and where I want things to go. And then I'm constantly like that cartoon of Wallace and Gromit where he's building the railroad track as the train is going. That's me as a GM. I'm constantly building it as I'm going. I have general ideas of where things are going, and, you know, and I may have an idea of where I think, you know, a good climax would be or a good season ender will be, but I'm making it all up as I go most of the time.
Yeah, but everyone is.
Yeah, I mean, I talk a good game about figuring out like the length of a campaign and everything like that, but like people plan and the gods laugh. Like yeah. That's, yeah.
I have this Eberron campaign I was running in Pathfinder that I wanted to go epic. So I made everything super epic, and everyone, each of the six PCs got a basically a tattoo that was essentially a Gaius on them telling them they had to go recover an artifact. And this was kind of what the campaign was going to be until they gathered all the artifacts and then had to fight the big bad at the end. We got halfway through. We got three of the six artifacts, and I kind of like spun it up too big too quickly. Mm. Not that the players knew all of it, but in my head, I'd basically kind of put myself in a corner, making the stakes too big to start with instead of building up to it. So we talk about stakes, which can be, you know, the big fights, the win or lose. So what are some dangers in your stakes that don't threaten a TPK or total party kill, for those that don't know? How can you, you know, what are some stakes you can do that aren't just death of the characters?
I mean, metaphorically, hold a gun to the heads of people they like. That's a huge way to up the stakes. In that same Rogue Trader game, I had like literally an invasion of their entire sector going on. And they didn't have to get involved with it, but man, did they pull back for 20 years and go to a war footing and come out swinging with like a 20 battleship heavy fleet, because you get mega wealth in that game, and that is no joke. but I think some of the best ways of doing that are just threaten externalities, threaten NPCs, threaten even the idea of the start, the taking from like JRPGs from the mid-90s, like flatten their starting town. Even if, you know, everybody gets scooped up and is safe, like they go back to one of the things that places they frequented earlier in the game and it's on fire, that's a huge point of escalation.
I will say this is all good stuff, but you want to be careful. You don't want to fridge the girlfriend.
No, don't fridge the girlfriend. I said threaten, don't fridge.
and by fridging the girlfriend, we refer to something from comic books where a Green Lantern character had his girlfriend killed by having her shoved in a fridge. And it was all basically to just motivate that character. And it was bad. It was very poorly done. And it's, you have to walk a very fine line when endangering the NPCs that your players care about without abusing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does. I mean, another way you can do that is have somebody that the players trust do a heel turn, but make their motivations clear so that, you know, they do a heel turn and it's not like, blah, ha, ha, you have fallen for my evil plan. I'd say, no, I had very logical reasons for doing this. I didn't trust you. I didn't believe you could do what you were saying. I had to save my family. I had to look out for myself. Whatever the reasons are, that threatens nothing.
I've seen this done where it was done to an NPC that the player created for their character's background, and it was done in such a way that it felt like this character that the NPC had created for their background was kind of ripped away from them. You can do this, just there are certain ways you need to go about it and be careful.
Yeah, that's a third act thing, the heel turn. Like, you got to give the player at least one or two acts of the campaign, whatever that means, whether that's session one and two and the heel turn on three. You have to give them, especially if it's from a player backstory, you have to respect what they put out there and give them what they said the character was to start with.
Right. Right.
One of the, when we do our Lines and Veils session zero stuff, one of the things that always ends up on there from our group is not taking away something that they've spent character time building without giving them a chance to stop it or save it. Right. I think the thing that Carl said, the thing about threatening, was very key, because threaten implies that they have a chance to fix it or stop it.
Right.
And that is really interesting. Like, if it's just the fridged girlfriend or some variation thereof, then they had no power to stop that. You're just And as the GM, you could do any of that, right? You don't have, like, you could just say, well, that happened in the background while you weren't there because I said so. And that's boring. That's real boring.
Yeah.
But turn it into an encounter where they can stop the serial killer from going after their family member, or they can stop the giant monster from stepping on their town, or at least try to, or at least, you know, maybe they can't stop the monster from stepping on the town, but they can rescue the people from the town or something like that. Then it's not them just showing up in the aftermath and being like, well, guess we got to go deal with this. They have so much more story involved in that, in giving them the agency to try to change events.
I think this is a place, too, where you can offer your players hard choices. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got two sets of NPCs, or you've got, like, a boyfriend in danger, and you've got a town in danger. Which one do your PCs go deal with? You know, like, that's one of those things that can also change the stakes, so to speak.
And then you can have the other one heel turn. Maybe they think they're leaving them to die, but they show up two sessions later going, like, you betrayed me. Of course I signed up.
Yeah. Oh, so delicious. I love all this. I think what we're getting at here is that TPK is the most boring stake you could possibly have. Like, emotionally damage those characters. That's the most interesting thing you could do.
I mean, let's just phrase it this way. Most of the times, the TPK is a burnt steak.
Yeah.
It's like you've gone to the restaurant, you paid a lot for this really expensive meal, and they overcooked your steak, and you're not going to enjoy it, and you're not going to come back to that restaurant, because I don't know where I'm going with this metaphor, but you get what I mean.
No, yeah, I get it. Oh, and social stakes. Failing their community, or failing the king, or, you know, disappointing their mother or something like that. The social aspect of not succeeding is also, like, juicy roleplay territory. Like, it doesn't have to be death on the line or destruction. It could just be a fall from grace.
Yep.
Yeah. So let's talk about some specific ways to tie the stakes to the player characters. People play RPGs in a lot of different ways. I personally enjoy when a game is very tailored to the characters that are in that game. And this goes both for the games that I run and the games that I play in. And I know there's other people out there who just, they want to play their character. They don't care what the adventure is. The GM wants to run their adventure. They don't care what players bring to the table. Let's talk about ways we can do this without, you know, without overwhelming a GM, making it a little easier, that type of thing.
Well, I'm going to riff off of what Carl said earlier with the way he reformatted the character's backstory. And podcast listeners won't see the range of expressions my face went through when he was telling that story. It started off with 25-page backstory, absolute horror on my face, and then turned it into a short story. Oh, now I'm interested. Anyway, but I always like to, if I don't work in the exact points of the backstory, you know, like maybe I used this example in a Gnome Stew article, right, where I had a player who gave me the backstory of, like, they became a rogue and a thief to steal enough money to pay for their sister's medical care, right? So that's why they were an adventurer. They needed gold to pay for a sick family member. Now, in the adventure, I didn't pull in that family member. What I did was I gave one of the villains the same motivation. So the villain had a sick son, and he was doing all of this theft and all these bad things to try to save the sick child. So that parallel backstory, like that mirroring of the character's backstory in the villain's backstory, immediately made the villain's motivations their motivations and raised the stakes and connected them that way in the character's mind.
That's really cool.
It's a really neat trick that if you use it well, it'll make people latch onto the story no matter what it is. And it's also not as heavy-handed as saying, like, your father is the villain. It's just, the villain did all of this shitty stuff that your father was doing, and that's the reason you left home. And doesn't that remind you of somebody?
Yeah.
It makes the players feel like it's about the players without narratively making everything revolve around the characters.
I think, kind of dovetailing off of that, going a little bit more smaller scale, I realize that I said that I don't generally think in terms of sessions. I think session stakes are a real nice area where players can kind of, you can tie things to players because they'll make small choices. I ran a D&D game during the pandemic for a couple of friends who had never played D&D before, and they really wanted to try it. I got to a an area that I dropped in a town I've used in like 7 or 8 other games. You know, we all have those ones that are easy to drop in, and we know the NPCs. They latched onto this town like I have never had anyone latch onto anything before. They were the first group of like 5 or 6 I've run through to actually dial in on the fact that the innkeeper had a thing for the brewery owner and all sorts of stuff. So there was a world-ending threat. And just like in an RPG, they immediately went, well, that's not what this 2 hours is going to be about. This 2 hours is going to be about making sure that they requite their unrequited love for each other, and then we go pony shopping. And it was legitimately one of the best sessions of the whole game because everyone was just in for it. So I think one of the things, I think just don't be afraid to let the players latch on to things that you didn't plan on to start with. It can be frustrating, but it can be really rewarding too.
I think that brings me to a point that I was thinking about this kind of in terms of the way some video games are set up, where they explain those world-ending stakes right at the beginning of the game. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there's all this other stuff you can do in between where you start and where you need to be. I hope this isn't spoiling anybody for Baldur's Gate 3, but you start Baldur's Gate 3 with a worm in your head that you have to get out or you're going to turn into a mind flayer. You start this game with that being your only focus, but you're not going to deal with that until 3 acts later. And I've heard talk of what's the game? There's one of the Fallout games where you're supposed to be searching for your lost child, but you have all this other stuff to do or that you can do in the middle. And so there's this kind of disconnect between the way the game plays and the stakes that are supposed to be driving your character. And I think this is a good reason why in our tabletop games, be careful about putting out those world-ending stakes too soon, because you want to let your players live in the world.
If you have goal-oriented players that are the kind to make to-do lists and get that dopamine hit by checking off the to-do items, if you have that world-ending threat too soon, then that is all they will focus on.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, nope, I don't care about all this stuff. We got to get this done because the meteor is going to hit. Like, what are you people waiting on? We don't have time to go shoe shopping. Mm-hmm. Your mileage will vary based on your table, obviously.
And kind of dovetailing off of the video game idea, I think a video game that does the stakes escalation really, really well is actually Octopath Traveler. If you guys have played it.
It's on my wish list.
PvP, yeah.
Oh man, play it. It's so good. You can play, so there's 8 characters and you can play through every single one of their storylines fully and completely and do all sorts of side quests. There's side quests that don't even unlock until after you're done with character stories, and you don't even find out the thread, like the full extent of the main plot until you have completely resolved all of their character stuff. So when you find out what's going on towards the end of the game, you can immediately divert all of your focus to it. But you still have that wonderful, like almost like borderline cozy game behind you. Mm-hmm. It's just a fantastic video game. I highly recommend it to anyone.
You know, this is also getting me thinking about one of my main gripes with World of Warcraft and MMOs. And it's probably just because the new expansion dropped. I've been playing it a lot. There's the main story quest, right? And it's, you know, big evil threat. You got to go take care of it and save the world again. And then there are the side quests where it's like, go herd my sheep for me. Or, you know, and like, you know, world champion who has saved us from apocalypse so many times. Can you get those apples out of the tree for me and collect them from the varmints that are stealing them? on the one hand, like, I get it for the content, right? But also, like, I think there's a difference between those low-stake, cozy aspects, like the going shopping and making sure that the barkeep gets together with the brewer. When those are player-motivated, perfect. Awesome. Everybody, like, you need to have those highs and lows in order to maintain interest. You can't be at 100% all the time. You need to dip down, give everybody a chance to refresh and everything like that. But in something like World of Warcraft, where it's essentially GM dictated that you deal with the world ending threat and then you also do some gardening. That's I think where the there's a disconnect.
A mechanic I like that you might be able to use is if you take the clocks mechanic from like the Forged in the Dark series, and you just be very explicit with the players about what's happening, that could be really interesting too. That way they know, like, okay, well, this is an 8-segment clock and we got like 3 on it, so we probably have time to go and do this side quest before we have to go deal with this problem. But that's also kind of like a stake escalation thing. You don't want to be like, 4-point clock, world ends. It's like, no, that's not going to get anything done. But like,
yeah,
in the game I'm running right now, like there's a religious schism brewing in one of the player characters' hometowns. And so I just have that clock on the world, like the world travel page. And every time they screw up or run into a danger, I'm like, here's another point on it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I love that idea.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up clocks, because they were something I kind of wanted to touch on, because they are a way you can, you know, because as a GM, we are playing everything else in the world, and we should be aware of what other groups, entities, whatever, are doing. And sometimes clocks can be a good way for you to know kind of what those behind the scenes stakes are as the players are doing whatever they're doing. On another note, one of the things I like to do for my players is make sure I point out the things that are relevant to their characters. One thing you can do is you can always ask your players, how do you know this person? When was the last time you were in this town? What does this remind you of from your history? And let them create some connections. But I tend to like having an idea of who the characters are, and then kind of pointing out things that might be relevant to them. In my Zendrick game that I was running, they fought a clockwork monster. It's not quite a Warforged. It was kind of pre-Warforged. But I pointed out a lot of the relevance of it to the Goblin Artificer, because this is stuff that's something he's interested in and relevant to. It makes that fight more interesting for that character.
Absolutely.
Anything else you guys want to say about stakes?
You got my joke. I was gonna say I like the medium rare. I do. I could have lied for humor's, but humor's steak, but humor's steak. Man.
It's hard to get beyond a point of general, like a couple points of general advice, because every bit of stakes is going to be so unique to your group of your campaign, your group of players.
Oh, I lied. Communicate them. Communicate the stakes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even if you think you're being blatant with your communication, but stakes, you're probably not. So be more blatant.
Oh, yeah.
At least be blatant and open to the players so that they can react as characters appropriately. Like, obviously, there's going to be some things you want to keep close to your chest. But, like, again, in the same game that I'm running, they know that their former White Mage companion has thrown her lot in with the Demon King. They know that. They decided that early on. They haven't met them. Their characters don't know that. But when they get there, they're going to have that, you know, that to draw on to do the role play part of it.
That's very cool.
And like you said with the clocks too, like the clocks let them know, like, okay, this is a stake, but it's not an immediate one. Right?
It is a skill that GMs learn on knowing what to keep, you know, like if we're, you know, what to keep behind the GM screen and what to make sure the players are aware of. Because this is a game we are all playing. We all need to enjoy it. And sometimes letting them know, letting the players know what's literally at stake is enough.
Yeah.
This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can Patreon backer by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, and our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, here's another show to check out.
Thacko with Advantage. Ange and Jared love talking about RPGs and D&D. Together, they share insights into the games they're running in the campaign journal, and then tackle a variety of topics that affect the game in the DM's workshop. They're going to talk about it anyway, so they might as well record it. Maybe you'll even pick up an ancient D&D factoid about a previous edition of the game that you'll never...
You can find all of us, well, you can find Josh and I at GnomeStew.com, along with GnomeStew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. Carl, where can we find you on the internet?
So I can mostly be found over on the Symphony Entertainment Discord, as well as on the Twitch stream from time to time. I just ran a Call of Cthulhu scenario set aboard a bomber during World War II that I'm very proud of. Ended up being a really fun cast. Please feel free to go check that out. And I also can be found on Instagram at DerHouseCarl, where you can take a look at some of my painted miniatures. Other than that, I try and keep a low profile and keep time in my back pocket for gaming.
Is there anything anybody else wants to give a shout out to?
There's a really cool Kickstarter that I can't really talk about because it's not coming out until a couple weeks after this podcast hits, and I don't think the details are finalized yet, so I'll just have to talk about it the next time I'm on Gnomecast. But in the meantime, I have been rediscovering my love of Obsidian. It is a note-taking app, completely open source, and there are a lot of great resources on how to use this for RPGs. Personally, my favorite thing is that it's got like wiki-style linking throughout the notes. And you can get this add-on for it that will automatically fill in the link. So if you are taking your GM notes and you start typing out an NPC name, it will autofill that NPC's note page and link you to that so you get all of their stats, all their back history, and all the things like that. It's wonderful. I love it.
That's cool. Are you talking Obsidian Portal?
No, I'm just talking about, it's just Obsidian is the name of the app, and it's completely free and open source, and it's amazing. Although I will warn you, it is a rabbit hole that you will fall down and you might not be able to crawl out of for several months.
Very cool.
That sounds amazing.
What I'm going to share is only slightly RPG related, but I found it amusing and thought I would share. Extra Credits is a great YouTube channel for video games, and they did a recent short called The MMO Acronym Accident. And it talks about how many of the acronyms we use all of the time, both in video games and TTRPGs, AOE, DPS, DOT, all came from the original EverQuest guide, and it was never supposed to happen that way. Give it a watch. It's pretty funny. Yeah. Carl, do you have anything else you want to give a shout out to?
It doesn't really need it, but I'm just going to shout out the game Octopath Traveler. and if you want a, again, both one and two, fantastic games. Start as very cozy JRPGs and just go epic in a very satisfying way. And if you feel like playing around in that world or making your own, I have to give a shout out to Fabula Ultima. I've now been running it for about 3 months. It's a fantastic game. The Discord for it is great. There's some amazing online tools. The creator of it every month updates his playtest and update notes just for free on the Patreon. So it's like basically under active development. You can just drop onto the Discord and ask him a question and he'll usually respond.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
It's just great. It's fantastic for many, many different reasons.
The physical books for it are also beautifully designed. They I don't have them, but every time I go to the game store, I'm like, I really want you, but I already have the PDFs and I don't know when I'm going to play you, so I shouldn't spend the money, but I really want you.
They're fantastic. And I can't wait because now that he's finished the last of the three setting or theme books, the rumor is he's doing a second version of the rule book. It's not like a second edition. It's just one with all of his updates and things like that. And I'm like, I can't wait to give you another $30 or $40. I can't wait to pay you money for this. I want you to keep doing this forever.
So do you think I set the stakes of throwing you into the stew strong enough to make you do this episode?
Well, they were communicated very well at the beginning.
They were. I have also developed a deep and abiding friendship with the stew, so I'm not going to go in yet, but I'm going to hang around for a while.